From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump spoke in the Capitol Rotunda, where the late Reverend Billy Graham lies in honor. Trump remembered hearing Graham preach in 1957.
My father said to me, "Come on, son." And by the way, he said, "Come on, Mom. Let's go see Billy Graham at Yankee Stadium." And it was something very special.
Well, this afternoon, Trump meets with a bipartisan group of lawmakers at the White House to talk about school and community safety. This as kids go back to school 2 weeks after the Parkland school shooting.
Here and now, political analysts join us now. Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, great to be with you.
Great to have you. And Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist with us as well. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, Robin and Jeremy.
Hey.
And let's start with the school shooting. We've heard a lot in the last couple of weeks about school safety, about gun control. President Trump, though, is no longer talking about raising the age limit to buy a gun. Alice, is he caving to NRA pressure, or what does he want on gun control?
Jeremy, I think he's still trying to formulate his plan for this. He's been very clear on certain aspects of this, specifically arming teachers or other people at the schools that are adept at firearms and willing to do so and take training, and hardening schools and doing away with the gun-free school zones. He feels that's important. He's clearly open to banning bump stocks. He's clearly has talked about the issue of raising the age, but I don't think he's clearly made up his mind on exactly what to do there. So there are many factors, and they're still in the discussion phase of this. So I think until we see it on paper, we don't really know where he stands on certainly the raising the age aspect.
But Alice, is that problematic? Because this is an issue that's been debated for decades, and it feels as if the train might be leaving the station without him. I want to ask you both how you read today's news that Dick's Sporting Goods, huge cross-country seller of different sporting goods, including guns, their CEO, Edward Stack, telling ABC's Good Morning America that his stores will never again sell assault-style weapons.
When we take a look at what those kids and the parents and the heroes in the school, what they did. And our view was if the kids can be brave enough to organize like this, we can be brave enough to take these out of here.
You want Congress.
And Jamal Simmons, Dix is also calling for Congress to ban assault-style weapons, raise the age to purchase any guns to 21. They're calling for universal background checks, including relevant mental health information, close the gun show loophole that skirts some of these screens. Of course, you could say that benefits, you know, their stores. But Jamal, does it feel as if, you know, others are pulling ahead of the president here?
Yes, Robin, this is just common sense. I think a lot of people who have been looking at this debate for years have thought, wow, aren't there just some small things we can do to try to make it tougher for people to get a hold of these weapons that they give out to people to actually go and fight in wars? I mean, maybe they're assault weapons, or maybe they're not technically assault weapons. People are certainly using them to assault other Americans in a really tough way. But then you have people like what happened in Georgia, where they're attacking Delta Airlines for not being involved, for pulling its support
from the NRA, the lieutenant governor.
Who's pulling, you know, support from the NRA. And in the tweets and the messages that he sends out, he says, "Protect yourself from the gangs and the illegal immigrants." And doesn't he know the people that are attacking our schools are not in gangs or illegal immigrants? They're American-born, lone, white gunmen. So it just feels like there's something more to this than just people worried about the Second Amendment. There are people who are appealing to us on a much more nativist and perhaps racist basis to protect these guns.
What about the Democrats, though, Jamal? I want to listen here to Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer talking about gun bills. Here he is.
We in Congress have an obligation to pass meaningful gun safety legislation that will save lives and tackle as many of the loopholes and problems with our gun laws as we can. Not just one narrow tweak at the margins.
It almost seems like the Democrats are not really part of the discussion right now. It certainly is not as much as President Trump is. Are they divided on the issue of guns, or what do you think, Jamal?
I do believe Democrats are divided, but they're not divided that we need to do something. They're just divided in how it is we talk about it, I think, and what maybe the thing is that we do. If you put a bill on the floor, I would bet you most Democrats would vote for it and it would pass.
Well, but what Schumer's saying right there is it's too narrow a bill. He wants, you know, there's a closing of some background check loopholes. He wants more.
Well, you know, don't get me started, because I think that we could go a lot further. You know, we realized at some point that fertilizer was being used in car bombs or, you know, in homemade bombs, and we began to restrict that. That didn't impugn farmers' rights for agriculture. I think we can do something about guns without taking away Americans' rights.
Alice, who's going to pay on this issue? Because people are angry. Who's going to pay in 2018? You've got Rick Scott, the Republican, expected to make a run against the Senator Bill Nelson, a Democrat. Rick Scott is going against the NRA in his state, a really risky thing to do. How do you think this is going to shape out?
Robin, it depends on how they play this out, how they take action on this. You've seen the polls, nearly 97%, almost 100% of the people in this country want to see some changes with regard to background checks, and the president is right on board with that. If we look at the different components that we have discussed, the background checks, the bump stocks, the hardening of the schools, the raising the age, I feel like Congress would be much better off if they picked issues they can come to an agreement on.
Well,
certainly
but you just
background
threw,
checks,
but,
let's
but,
pass that.
But you just threw the hardening of the schools in there, and that's the one thing that the Democrats don't want to see. Nobody that throwing that in there is not a small thing, you know, arming teachers, for instance.
Certainly. Well, then let's look at what we can agree on. Background checks. We need to improve the background check system. We need to make sure that information is put into the NICS system. The Fix NICS bill is really important. The system to check on people's background is only as good as the information that is put into the system. So we need to incentivize law enforcement and the military and health officials to put the information in there. So when background checks are conducted, the proper information is there. So that, in my view, if Congress were to get together on what they can agree on, and that is one issue that they do, let's pass something now and progressively work to the things that are more problematic, because the people, as you said, people do want change. And Rick Scott, I've worked for Rick Scott. He is very passionate about this, and I applaud him for taking swift and decisive action on this. But clearly Washington and Congress is having a much more difficult time. But I think we should find areas where there is agreement and pass some meaningful legislation and then work on the more difficult things down the road.
I just want to get to a couple more things while we have both of you. On the issue of the Russia investigation, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort pleaded not guilty to additional charges today. There was also news this week that a White House advisor Jared Kushner's security clearance was downgraded, and President Trump again tweeting mean things about Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Jamal, what do you think's going on? Are we about to get to an important point in the Mueller investigation?
It seems to me like the president's trying to deflect everyone away from what's most important here. Listen, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, now has a security clearance beneath the clearance that I think junior assistants at the Department of Commerce have higher security clearances than what Jared Kushner has. And he's supposed to be the lead Middle East negotiator. It's almost impossible for him to do his job. And what we're discovering is it's not just his past behavior that is concerning these security officials. It's the way he's conducted himself since getting his job at the White House. And perhaps he's meeting with people who are trying to take advantage of him, and he's not taking the proper precautions to protect himself, the government, and the White House. The president has a problem with the people he associates with. And I think the problem is that the president is shady and everybody is now starting to figure it out.
And I think Jamal hit the nail on the head, the president trying to deflect here. Yesterday, Jared, his son-in-law, was in the hot seat, and he didn't like that. So if he sent out a disrespectful tweet concerning
You don't want to call
Jeff
it a
Sessions,
mean tweet like I did.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. But if he did that, then Jared's no longer capturing the headlines. Huh. It's the attorney general. And look, I think Jeff Sessions was correct and asking the inspector general to investigate this. They are the ones that should be checking into FISA abuses, and he was correct to do so. So it's inappropriate, again, for the president, in my view, to be second-guessing what Jeff Sessions is doing simply because he's frustrated that Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation.
Well, you know, it's one thing to be asking about Jared Kushner's security clearances, but then we have those reports that at least four countries have been talking about ways to manipulate him because of some of his financial entanglements. Look, I just before we go, we only have about a minute here, but Jamal, just take this. What is there to say about Housing Secretary Ben Carson decorating his office with a $31,000 custom-made dining table set. There was a hutch as well, a dining table and a hutch. A HUD employee says she was demoted for flagging this. I mean, this ordinarily would be a huge headline.
Yeah, listen, I would say lots of politicians get stuck in this when they get involved in government, when they haven't been in government, and all of a sudden they, you know, spend too much money. The problem here is now he's punishing the people who are telling the story about what happened. At the same time, he was told not to give contracts to his kids, and then he still wanted to give contracts to the kids, the companies his kids were a part of. This is a bigger problem, and it's ripe. It goes throughout the Trump government.
All right. Well, I applaud the whistleblower for speaking out and telling her story and shining light on something that I think shouldn't have happened.
That's Alice Stewart, Republican strategist, and Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Everybody agreed.
Thank you, Rob
and Jeremy. Take care.
Remember when President Trump called the school resource officer outside the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School a coward for not running into the building during the shooting rampage? The guard, Scott Peterson, later said he thought the shooting was outside. But Trump told the governors he was addressing he wouldn't have backed away.
You know, I really believe you don't know until you test it, but I think I really believe I'd run in there even if I didn't have a weapon. And I think most of the people in this room would have done that, too. But the way they performed was really a disgrace.
Well, that launched a storm of ridicule from those pointing out that they saw Trump as running away from service in Vietnam with 5 deferments. The Boston Globe quotes combat vets like Michael Stalky, sympathetic to the guard. Michael tweeted, "I've seen folks freeze during exercises with blanks. Your buddy whacks you on the head, tells you to get moving. One man alone, they don't have that support." But our next guest was more likely thinking about the use of the word coward over the course of history. Fear of being called a coward has started wars, but also propelled soldiers to win them. And what about moral cowardice, being afraid to do the morally right thing, especially if people will think you're a coward for doing so? What about the problem with the word for young men who are afraid to back down from a deadly fight lest they be called a coward? And Boston University professor Chris Walsh also writes, when it comes to policy, the word coward oversimplifies, insinuates that questions of policy are matters of machismo, that decisiveness is best, even if the decision to take action may be wrong. His book is Cowardice, A Brief History, and Chris Walsh joins us. Welcome.
Thanks.
And what was your first thought when you heard the president use this word, coward?
I'm not terribly surprised. The word gets trotted out a lot in these terrible situations. The slight wrinkle being that this time, in the case of Mr. Peterson, he was apparently supposed to be doing something that he did not do. Usually the word is applied to the mass shooter, to the terrorist.
For taking action.
Right.
So take us a little bit through the history. The word coward has propelled presidents like Lyndon Johnson, who said he thought he'd be called a coward if he didn't continue the war in Vietnam. Right. It's propelled soldiers. Give us a little bit of the history of it.
Right. Well, it's the driving force behind so much violent conflict. You can't really have a war if everybody agrees to be cowardly. And so we see in American history, for example, the first thing George Washington has to do when he takes over the Continental Army is to confirm court-martial cases for cowardice and to lament that such a crime is the worst thing that somebody can do because it can endanger not only one's immediate comrades, it can lose a war. The combination of being terribly destructive in that way, but also kind of pathetic. I mean, you think of the cowardly lion, this sense of being abject. And so that combination of destructiveness and patheticness disgusts us. So we slap it on any terrible thing that happens.
Well, but you say, when you say us, I mean, let's just think of us as Americans mm-hmm. right now. You actually write that there are cultures that are warmongers. I mean, we think of ISIS, right? That is their whole purpose.
Right.
And the entire culture is about fighting and that's what they're about.
Right.
But the beauty of being Americans is that we can sing, as you write, of being the home of the brave, but also know that fear of warfare is wise.
Right.
So that's not cowardice.
Right. That's prudence.
And so when is cowardice prudence?
Well, I'll give you a definition of cowardice that I think holds up across time and culture, and that is a failure from excessive fear to do one's duty. When one does one's duty, no problem. When one fails in duty because of a fear that is just, then one isn't being cowardly. We look at that definition and ask ourselves, okay, what is the duty called for in this case? What I regret about the way the label coward is used when we hear it in the news is typically it's a way of distracting us from things. I think the concept is actually really helpful, more ethically useful than courage or heroism, because it pushes us to ask questions. It's typically used as an answer to a question. Oh, those Boston Marathon bombers, why'd they do it? They were cowards, right?
Well, and you go even deeper. I mean, you really deep dive into this one word, coward. And there is the thing that somebody might do that somebody might call cowardly, but it's actually the thing that's avoiding a terrible blunder.
Right.
People in the 60s who left the country to go to Canada,
right,
so they wouldn't participate in the war in Vietnam, were called cowards.
Right.
Later, even McNamara saw it differently. Then there's also the kind of thing that would be called cowardice that is such a deep fear that you can't act. I mean, I'm thinking of that soldier who wrote after Donald Trump's claim that he wouldn't be a coward. There's an actual physical inability. As you say, trauma can break even the bravest of people down.
Yeah, and I think we've come to a greater recognition of that in the past century or so. And so we understand that soldiers in particular who have to deal with repeated instances of combat, everybody's account of fortitude runs dry eventually, and we don't hold it against them anymore.
After the president's remarks, there was also a huge thread from a group, hashtag Vets for Gun Reform,
mm-hmm,
saying things like, you have no idea how scary it is to
right
face a military-style weapon or an AR-15.
Right.
And they right seemed more forgiving of, again, we don't know what happened
right
to Mr. Peterson, but
yeah,
they seemed more forgiving of his inability to go in with his shotgun.
Right.
Than others were.
Yeah, they know the particulars of the situation and have experience there. Yeah, and it's also no accident that we hear from soldiers about that. Soldiers have been great leaders of peace movements.
Well, tell us more about this notion that using the phrase coward, again, it helps nations rise up when they see something that needs to be attacked in times of desperate need, think World War II, is a way to get the troops out there. But when else in history did it lead to a mistake, a notion that somebody felt less masculine if they didn't respond?
Well, you referred to LBJ, as I believe in 1965, pondering what to do in Vietnam and deciding to escalate involvement because, as he said, if I leave South Vietnam, I will be seen as a coward and my nation will be seen as an appeaser. Can look back at the Civil War and the lead up to that, both sides marshaling support for their cause by saying that people that didn't support them were cowardly. Soldiers on the ground they've been studied about their motivation, and very few of them aspire to be heroes. What applies to all of them is that none of them want to be thought of as cowards. Mm. And that's what makes soldiers do their duty, stand sentry, charge, attack if necessary, not because they want to be heroes, but because they don't want to be seen as yellow.
You write in 1914, although Germany had complicated reasons for declaring war, one of them was the Kaiser's concern about being thought a coward. The war that came, the Great War, Teddy Roosevelt called President Woodrow Wilson the leader of a cult of cowardice for not
right
getting
yeah
involved in that war.
Yeah. But if instead we look at that definition and ask ourselves, okay, what is the duty called for in this case?
So it's been used over the decades, especially when it comes to war. But what are your thoughts on how it impacts policy?
Right.
So now you have a president calling a security guard a coward. And, by some of the definitions we've just said, he may have been.
Mm-hmm.
He may have frozen.
Right.
He may have thought, I can't go in there. I can't fight an assault rifle with a gun. We don't know.
Right.
Or he may have, as he said, he may have thought the shooting was outside and he's not
right
a coward at all.
Right.
But now we're talking about policy. The implication is, therefore, we need to arm teachers in schools. Talk about the use of the word coward as affecting policy.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's typically very helpful in considering policy. It leads to a sense that nuance is a kind of weakness, that being decisive is best, even if the decision is wrong. a kind of knee-jerk escalation reaction. Oh, somebody had a gun. Well, we'll get two guns.
And or a bigger gun.
Right, or a bigger gun.
But you also say that there's another side effect of people being afraid of being called cowards.
Yeah, and that can lead to reckless behavior. And so putting guns in the hands of teachers or in the desks of teachers puts them in a situation where they have to wonder if it is their duty to wield that weapon, or they'll be called cowards. And history has shown that most of the time that won't end well.
You also remind us of one of the great books that tackles this issue of what is courage, what is cowardice. It's Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage. It's about a Union soldier, Civil War, who a teen who had these dreams of glory.
Right.
Then he comes upon the real thing, real battle. He's afraid. He runs away.
Right.
And over the course of like making his way through these battlefields, he gets a wound. But it has nothing to do with war. He's in somebody's way and they hit him with a rifle butt. And he thinks he's the only one, and he meets another soldier.
Right.
Who was afraid and ran away. And that actually gives him the courage to fight. He's not the only one. You talk about there being that thin line between cowardice and courage.
Right. Yeah, where the fear of being cowardly can drive one to do courageous things. It's led to terrible wars, but it's also preserved nations and won battles. As I said, I lament the simplification of slapping this label of coward on people and not thinking about it, giving it, it's presenting it as a kind of an answer. When we think about cowardice with care, we actually ask questions. What is our duty in a given situation? What are we so afraid of?
Well, in the case of the Red Badge of Courage, it's only when he realized that it's human nature, that somebody else was scared too, that he could then find his courage. Boston University Professor Chris Walsh, again, the book is Cowardice, A Brief History. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sure English teachers are going to give me a failing grade on my quick synopsis of Red Badge of Courage. But everyone, your thoughts. What is a coward? What does that mean to you?
The Trump administration appears to be rethinking its opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. President Trump railed against that trade deal during the campaign. He pulled out of it last year. But Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said yesterday that renegotiating the trade agreement was, quote, on the table. Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. He joins us now. Hi, Robin.
Jeremy, how are you?
Doing well. And Steven Mnuchin was speaking at the Chamber of Commerce. Tell us more about what he said on the TPP.
Well, you know, for starters, it's pretty much, you know, baby, come back. You could blame it all on me. I mean, in all seriousness, he was merely saying that the door was open to a renegotiation that allows the United States to more underscore its interests. So conceding less and extracting more from the smaller economies in the partnership.
Okay. Well, the TPP was negotiated under President Obama. And as a candidate, President Trump, or Donald Trump at the time, had very harsh words for the deal. This is from a rally in Ohio in the summer of 2016.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is another disaster done and pushed by special interests who want to rape our country, just a continuing rape of our country. That's what it is, too. It's a harsh word. It's a rape of our country.
Okay, not mincing any words there. That was the summer of 2016. And then here's the president last week during his joint press conference with the Australian prime minister.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership was not a good deal for us. And if they made it a good deal for us, I'd go in. But honestly, it wasn't. I like bilateral deals much more than multilateral.
Okay, so he's still kind of keeping the door somewhat closed there. But why now? Why this sort of change from him and from the Treasury Secretary?
Look, it's great to throw populist red meat during an election, especially if you're running as a deal maker and I'm going to bring these jobs back and it's a one-way street with these multilateral arrangements. Like, put me in a room with another person and I can strike a better deal. Still, the United States is the only true economic and geostrategic counterweight to China. And that giant shadow falls over the many nations still trying to keep TPP together, from, you know, Japan to Australia, Vietnam, even Peru.
Because so China's not in this deal, by the way.
No,
China's
no,
not in
no.
The TPP.
But at the same time, China's looming large. It's throwing its weight around in shipping corridors, with naval exercises. You saw this week its premier is moving to act more like an emperor. So all of our allies in the Pacific region are desperate for a U.S. counterbalance. And Trump himself is being prodded by dozens of pro-trade GOP lawmakers, and even the leader of Australia, and they're dangling more trade money in front of us.
But would other countries that are part of TPP and had to spend a long time sort of rewording the deal after the U.S. pulled out, would they be willing to make the kind of changes that President Trump would want in order to bring the U.S. back in?
Look, when this thing started under the Obama administration and in 2016 with the signing, you had a dozen countries sporting about 40% of global economic output. They banded together. They want to boost trade, streamline regulations, and become ultimately like a ginormous bloc like the EU. The problem is all those countries need to ratify it. And without the United States in it, it takes a huge incentive, a huge bargaining chip out. So Trump seriously threatened the whole thing. But Japan has been keeping it together, and now the United States has bargaining leverage to go back in.
All right. We'll see what happens with the TPP. I thought that story was over, but maybe it is not. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To mark the end of Black History Month, we want to bring you part of a documentary on freed slaves. At the end of the Civil War, a century and a half ago, 4 million African-American slaves were emancipated. Most possessed no more than the clothes on their backs and were suddenly homeless and without income. In the chaos following the war, where would they go? How would they reunite with their family? David Freudberg of Humankind explores this history in his new documentary, The Freed People.
The Civil War began in 1861 because the Southern states had illegally seceded from the Union. President Abraham Lincoln didn't emancipate the slaves for another 2 years. But the slaves themselves recognized the war at the start as their opportunity for freedom. Howard University historian Edna Greene Medford.
And as a consequence, many of them left the plantations even before the Emancipation Proclamation.
Some slaves, as the Civil War drew close to them, attained freedom by fleeing to the Union forces, where they were generally protected. Others remained captive on the plantations, where people were degraded as a matter of course and could be tied and savagely whipped for disobedience, treated as subhuman. But at least the grim situation there was mostly stable.
They knew where the food was. They knew what their jobs were. They lived under terrible conditions in some cases.
Yale University historian David Blight.
But the war brought fear, chaos, and exhilaration. Their circumstances were confusing as well. I mean, what did the war mean? You know, if you're a slave in Georgia, you're a slave in Tennessee or Virginia, where so much of the war is fought in 61 and 62, your fondest hope is that these Union armies, these Yankee armies, are going to come liberate you.
This is from a 1921 performance of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, a Negro spiritual inspired by the biblical story of Prophet Elijah ascending in a chariot to the deliverance of heaven. It was composed around 1860 by a freedman named Wallace Willis in southern Oklahoma.
In Virginia, early in the war, one of the reasons that emancipation became such a crucial issue is because of the escape of slaves into Union lines. Famously, Benjamin Butler's lines at Norfolk, Virginia. And he is the one who, in the summer of 1861, decided to call them contraband of war, that is, confiscated property of the enemy. And the term, the idea that slaves would be contraband of war if you reach Union lines, spread all over the South.
It actually immediately circulates in minstrel shows, the contraband, as a person.
Historian Abigail Cooper of Brandeis University.
And it's such an ironic term because even slave, you expect to be a human, but contraband is a thing. And so just like the the oxen and blankets, they also confiscate people. And this is the grounds on which they say, well, anything that's used in service of the rebellion should be confiscated. And on those terms, then, not only black men who could be potentially laborers and then soldiers, but also women and children come in and they're not returned to owners who come seeking them. And that's what creates these camps.
There were 25 odd such camps formed by the War Department and the Union armies by 1863 into 1864, all around the rim of the South. Famous ones in around Washington, D.C., famous one in Corinth, Mississippi, and so forth and so on. But those were essentially refugee camps.
You had instances of people starving to death.
Edna Green Medford.
People in some of those contraband camps that had contracted all kinds of diseases because of overcrowding. You had people being murdered by local whites. You had them being mistreated by the Union soldiers who were there to protect them.
You put hundreds, if not thousands, of people together in camps, and you've got a disease environment.
Yale historian David Blight.
And we now have some evidence that in the range of, this is just estimates, possibly one of every four freedmen who made it to a contraband camp died in the process.
Wow.
So emancipation is not a day of jubilee. It's a process of freedom through hardship.
How many of these folks ended up in the refugee camps?
In the process of emancipation from 1861 to 65, roughly 600,000 slaves were freed. That is, they were within Union lines or in the Union Army and Navy by, let's say, 1864 or the end of the war.
Congress had authorized an American Freedmen's Inquiry Commission in 1863, and they sent people through the South just looking at the conditions of the formerly enslaved, people who had already been freed as a consequence of the Emancipation Proclamation and were living in areas that were under Union control. And so they discovered then that there was all of this suffering from just having been released from slavery, you know, overnight and then having no way to take care of themselves and the government not being able to do it.
In 1865, near Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia, General Robert E. Lee would surrender to his Union counterpart, Ulysses S. Grant. Just 5 weeks earlier, the Federal Freedmen's Bureau, officially named the U.S. Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, came into existence.
And the basic reason for its existence is to ensure the survival of the freed people, to protect their rights, to make sure that they can survive with the basic necessities. So the Freedmen's Bureau is attempting to provide food, clothing, shelter, medical care. So they're doing all of these things to try to help the freed people to make their transition from slavery to freedom.
Even during the war years, but especially when the war is over in 65, all the way up into the 1880s, you see ads in newspapers, particularly black newspapers, looking for my husband, my father, my mother, my brother, last seen in 1864 at such and such, last seen in 1866 at such and such. If you know of him, see of him, please contact me with an address.
There was a great deal of criticism of African Americans at the end of the war because it seemed everybody was on the roads. And so you had people who were observing, saying that African Americans were idle, that they didn't want to work, and they were just clogging the roads. Well, yes, they're clogging the roads because they're trying to find loved ones who had been sold away. And many of them are never able to reestablish their families, but they try. They do contact the Freedmen's Bureau agents. They send letters, and we know about this because these letters are in the Freedmen's Bureau records.
Some people would come into the Freedmen's Bureau agents and say, look, I want to put out a plea to find my mother. I've heard she went to Memphis in 63, but I never saw her again, and yet I heard from an aunt that she was still alive in 65, and so forth, that kind of thing. It's extraordinary. They're trying to relocate and reassemble family.
So you have an instance of a man named Hawkins Wilson who had been in Virginia and had been sold to Texas and had left behind his entire family. And 24 years later, in 1867, he's writing to the Freedmen's Bureau. He's trying to reconnect with his family in Virginia. And he remembers everything. He talks about what it was like when he left the night that he was sold away and how one of his sisters made biscuits for him. And he talked about the fact that he said, thank God that we can now not have to worry about being sold and separated from loved ones.
A group of medical organizations and drug makers have written a letter to Congress to find new ways to fund the development of antimicrobial drugs such as antibiotics. As the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, which helps fund government responses to disasters with things like vaccines, comes up for reauthorization in September. An industry spokesperson says, think of aircraft carriers and missiles. Well, this bill funds products that play the same role, but in defense of public health. And every year in the U.S., at least 2 million people are infected with bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. At least 23,000 die because of those infections. Ike Swetlitz is Washington correspondent with our partners STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Ike, we've heard of drug companies looking for financial incentives to put time and effort into developing drugs. The writing of this letter was led by the Infectious Diseases Society of America, and they told you they were hoping for something called a market entry reward, you know, millions just to start their work. And a Pfizer spokesperson told you they want something called transferable exclusivity in the ultimate bill. What is that?
Yeah, so this letter is asking for economic incentives in general. And in meetings with congressional offices, you know, different signatories sort of pushing their own ideas. So what Pfizer told me they're supporting is this idea of transferable exclusivity, which is where a company that's developing a certain drug, maybe a new antibiotic, would get a voucher to extend the exclusivity of a different one of their products. So they'd be able to keep competitors off the market for longer. They could also sell that voucher to another company if they wanted to do that too.
Well, what's the sense here, Ike? This sounds an awful lot like these drug makers kind of holding the government hostage. You know, you give us this or else we won't develop these antibiotics. Or is it that expensive for them to develop something for a market that really is only the government, not a wider market?
Right. So one of the challenges to developing these is that you really don't want to use antibiotics any more than you absolutely need to, because if you use them too much, then the bacteria will become resistant to them, which is the situation that we have right now. Mm-hmm. So companies can't and really, you know, don't want to market them the same way they market other drugs. So they just can't make as much money on them. But it's really important to have them around when you need them. So they need other sorts of economic incentives other than, you know, the regular market.
Right. These are going to be stockpiled. Hopefully we don't have to use them, but they'll be stockpiled by the government in the event of emergency. So the companies are saying they need a little financial incentive to do that.
Right. Or they, you know, could be used in a hospital if there's a need for it, but, you know, they don't want to be overused or overprescribed.
Right. But still, what is the sense? I mean, we do have the sense that drug makers have billions of dollars to develop drugs. Is there a sense that they're playing ball here?
So there are incentives that exist currently, and a lot of, you know, academics, economists, companies have been calling for more or maybe slightly different forms of incentives. Mm. So I think that the discussion is going to be over which sort of incentives are most effective, and maybe not the idea of whether or not there should be incentives
right.
at all.
There's agreement there. Well, but what is the antibiotic picture right now?
As you said before, there are a lot of infections that have become resistant to the antibiotics that are around. And, you know, this can show up anywhere from you have surgery and you get an infection during the surgery to, I mean, if something the government might be thinking about, if there's nuclear attack, and for the people who are still alive and have severe burns, those burns get infected. I mean, there's the sort of it runs the spectrum there, which is why the government's interested in it in this bill from a national security perspective.
Yeah. Well, but this administration in particular has not been friendly to science. Is there a sense that these requests will be taken seriously and will make their way into the new Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, which, as we said, has to be, you know, re-upped?
By all accounts, this is a fairly bipartisan process, and the members of Congress who are leading it are, you know, trying to frame it, like I said before, as a national security issue, too. So it's, you know, not just the development of a new antibiotic, but it's the development of a tool that will help the country protect itself.
Mm. And so your sense is there will be success.
It seems like some sort of incentive, you know, will work its way in. As I said, there are already some sorts of incentives, and you know, it's just a matter of time to see and to see how the lobbying plays out as to what those will actually be.
That's Ike Swetlitz, Washington correspondent with our partners at STAT. Ike, thank you so much.
Thank you.